Rise to Rebellion, Disc 12.
Chapter 31. Adams. Lexington, April 30th, 1775. His visit was official. To learn firsthand from the militia leaders there what preparations had been made, what could be done to prevent the British troops from marching so freely through the countryside, what the necessities might be for maintaining a well-equipped defensive force. But the official meetings would wait, something drawing him first to the wide green, some hand leading him in the footsteps of the men who had fallen there, a pull that was far beyond mere curiosity. Like so many in the colony who read the accounts or heard the talk, he could not yet simply accept that every hope, every bit of optimism, had suddenly been swept away, that in one awful day the last hope for resolving the crisis was shattered completely by musket fire. It would simply not be real until he could see it himself, walk the ground. He walked the green in no particular direction, found himself searching for signs of the fight, the telltale stain of blood in the thick grass. From the moment when he had first ridden into Lexington, he had felt himself staring at the simple beauty of the wide green, and he knew it was unavoidable. He knew he would have to follow the footsteps, stand in the bloody tracks. He had fought it in his mind, did so now, stared out across the green as he left the carriage. "Why must you do this? Are you so morbid? This is not what is important." But he couldn't keep the nightmare away, and as he crossed the hard road and stepped into the lush grass, he found himself reliving the horrible shock of another time, staring at the blood in the snow. That one awful night 5 years before. Then it had been called a massacre. Now what? Sam will have his name for it, the story already written, making the best use of the horrible details, enrage and infuriate, manipulate the people to a frenzy of revenge. So much depended on the skill of the writer, the fiery speeches of the orator. But this time we have much more than grand pronouncements, glorious pamphlets decorated with vicious cartoons. Now we have this. Sam would call them martyrs. But that is only part of the story. This time there are dead on both sides. It should not be so easy to separate the two, as though we accept with such certainty that one side is completely evil, the other virtuous. And yet, this did not have to happen. This was brought about by the blind arrogance of a government that believes it can simply force its citizens to succumb to any punishment, any whim of their king. Where is the virtue in that? Does General Gage dare to sit in his office and claim that his men died because of us? He stopped walking, felt a sudden burst of clarity, imagined Thomas Gage sitting behind the grand desk, writing his reports, explaining it all to London. Well, yes, he will claim that. All the blame will be cast here on these men, the citizens who believed they were simply defending their own. In London, the government will listen to Gage's version, rebels killing the king's soldiers. No matter who was right, who started it, who fired first, there can be no middle ground. And that is why there will be a war. He looked out beyond the green, saw people watching him, some moving past. He studied the buildings, saw the tavern, the place he would meet the militia commanders, began to walk that way. He rolled the word through his mind. War. They will not want to hear that in Philadelphia. But I will make sure they do. Philadelphia, May 10th. 1775. Adams had never expected to return to Philadelphia, had shared the feeling with many of the more radical members of the First Continental Congress that for all the celebration of the very existence of that body, little had truly been accomplished. But even those who dismissed the importance of the debates and lectures, the numbing speeches and endless politicking, had to concede that in some unexplainable way the First Congress had opened the door to something very new and unique. Despite the monumental differences in the delegates and their views, it had been a system that had actually worked. And none could say that it was some fluke, the cooperation born of a crisis that had now ceased to exist. Not only did the crisis still exist, but with the bloodshed at Lexington and Concord, it had grown much worse. The Second Congress was called to meet on May 10th, and Adams found himself selected again, had accepted with graciousness, surprised that anyone in Massachusetts could find something to admire in his service the first time around. The other delegates from Massachusetts were appointed again as well, with one addition, John Hancock. Hancock was in all likelihood the wealthiest man in the colony, and some said the richest in all of New England. Though considered notorious by Loyalists for his smuggling activities, much of his wealth was actually inherited from his father, who had been a most successful businessman. Hancock had taken to Sam Adams, drawn not only to Sam's personal magnetism, but to the power of his words and the power of Sam's talent for rousing the people. Hancock was known to have great ambition, especially when it came to his role in the Sons of Liberty. Though Hancock believed he had a potential for some lofty position in the scheme of things, Sam understood that Hancock's most useful asset was his wealth, that Hancock's willingness to underwrite many of the expenses involved in mounting the opposition to the crown made him an essential part of the organization. Hancock's selection to serve in the Second Continental Congress was more of a reward for his generosity than because of anyone's belief that he actually had much ability to get things done. This time, the delegates did not make the journey together. Their triumphant parade across New England and New York, Sam Adams and Hancock had made their way south shortly after their escape from Lexington. The others had followed soon after. As he had done before, Adams had first tended to the farm and tied up the loose ends of his law practice. After the visit to Lexington, he had made one final visit to Braintree and had begun to journey southward, suffering from the effects of some illness. He endured the long ride with bouts of fever and misery, passed through small towns that did not celebrate his passing, but met him with respectful salutes, town squares and open roads now alive with the drill and assembly of new militia. The delegates had chosen a new, larger site for their meetings, the Pennsylvania State House. Many of the faces were familiar, the men still considered the most thoughtful and prominent in their colonies. The illness had finally given him relief, and he spent his first day shaking hands and sharing greetings, both casual and serious. He had sought out the Virginia delegation first, had hoped their sentiment was still for unity with Massachusetts, was relieved to find Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, the imposing figure of the one man who wore a uniform, the commander of the Virginia militia, Colonel George Washington. There were new faces as well, and if John Hancock was known outside of Massachusetts, and thus did not always need introduction, some of the faces were new to everyone. Virginia had added one new delegate, a quiet young man, wide-eyed with his new responsibility. Adams had shaken the man's hand, saw the same look he had seen in so many of the others, a fire in the eyes that revealed a mind that would move quickly past the verbiage of endless debate, a young man who brought a fresh energy that Adams knew they would need. His name was Thomas Jefferson. There were familiar faces who did not inspire pleasantries. The men from Pennsylvania, particularly the one man whose views had not changed, the one man who would still lead the opposition to what Adams saw as the prime mission of the Congress. John Dickinson had taken Adams' hand with cordiality, had even expressed a deep sadness over the events in Massachusetts. But Adams could see beyond the man's patronizing show of sympathy. Dickinson was still a staunch pacifist who believed a reconciliation with England was the only course. As Adams drifted through the crowd, he began to hear whispers, men pointing toward the door. He was becoming used to this, the sudden recognition of some new arrival, the outburst of greeting. But the men stayed back, no one calling out a name, and Adams was curious. Slid between two men, heard the whispers still. He moved forward, could see the doorway now, one man standing alone, much older, short and round, peering out over tiny spectacles. Adams boldly strode forward, his usual shyness replaced by a quick stab of excitement. He held out a hand. "Dr. Franklin, we have not met, sir. I am John Adams of Massachusetts." Franklin seemed to perk up, took his hand. "Ah, yes, Mr. Adams, unlike so many, the man who thinks before he speaks. We find ourselves in interesting times, do we not? Adams could feel others moving close behind him, their hesitation gone now, men lining up to meet this one man who was known to them all. The place was called Ticonderoga, a British fort far above New York that guarded the mouth of the Hudson River as it flowed south out of Lake Champlain. Despite the strategic importance to the British, the fort had been largely ignored, and few in Gage's command had considered that any serious threat existed to a place so far removed from the talk of rebellion. But besides the fort's geographic position, the colonists had discovered Ticonderoga's true importance, contained within the fort's crumbling walls, were nearly 80 cannon. Two separate expeditions had formed, both targeting the fort, commanded by two very different kinds of men. Ethan Allen led the Green Mountain Boys, a ragtag group of mountaineers, while Colonel Benedict Arnold carried the official sanction of the Massachusetts Assembly. When the two operations learned of each other, there was conflict, and when Arnold attempted to exert his official seniority, the Green Mountain Boys made it clear they would accept no other authority than Allen. The compromise was reached, and in a cold night, swept by the misery of wind and rain, Arnold and Allen stood side by side at the entranceway of the fort, backed by Allen's men. The stunned British command had no defense, and with barely a casualty, the strange assembly of rebels had captured not just a cornerstone of British pride, but enough artillery to provide a deadly new power to the siege of Boston. Philadelphia, May 28, 1775. There had been outrage from the conservative voices of the Congress when news of the capture of Ticonderoga had reached Philadelphia. But when a proposal was made to offer an official apology to the British and a resolve was put forward calling for the return of the fort and its spoils to Gage's command, the outcry from both the radicals and the moderate delegates was long and loud. A compromise was agreed to. As long as the crisis existed with the government in England, the fort and its artillery would remain in colonial hands. From the first days of the session, Adams had expected a great show of sympathy from the entire Congress for the catastrophes of Lexington and Concord, but it was soon apparent that hesitation and timidity had replaced the fiery calls for action. Though nearly everyone agreed that the British had put events into unstoppable motion by the deaths in Massachusetts, many of the conservatives found their own ammunition for placing blame on the colonists themselves, evidenced certainly by the capture of Ticonderoga. John Hancock was now the president of the Congress, succeeding Peyton Randolph, who had been called back to Virginia on some pressing business. The Massachusetts delegation had applauded the selection, quietly aware that Hancock himself had vigorously worked the delegates for their consideration. It had already been a long, drawn-out day, and Adams was feeling genuinely depressed, had endured a long harangue by Dickinson, the other Massachusetts delegates around him sitting silently fuming at the amazing speech. He endured Dickinson's words by staring at Hancock, could see grim impatience, the monotony of Dickinson's speech broken by sudden bursts of commentary, more speakers chiming in, some in support of Dickinson, calls for unity with England, for the astounding offer of an apology to King George. Adams glanced around, could feel the mood of the entire room, frustration, each part of the argument digging deeply into the patience of the men of both sides. Dickinson seemed to have finished his presentation, but he continued to stand silent for a long moment, and then Hancock quieted the room. "Does Mr. Dickinson wish to continue?" Dickinson looked straight at Adams, and Adams straightened in his chair as he felt the man's gaze. "Forgive me, gentlemen. I am not one to occupy this Congress with hollow oratory. I wish only to remind the honorable delegates from Massachusetts of one fact. Outside of this hall in Pennsylvania, or Maryland, or New York, are the homes of men who still believe themselves to be Englishmen. Throughout the 13 colonies, yes, even in Massachusetts, around the hearths of the vast majority of the people, the name of King George is still venerated. Prayers are said for His Majesty's health. prayers are said for an end to this break with our mother country. The overwhelming sentiment in this land, in all of this land, is for the peace to return. Our brothers in England have made missteps, errors in judgment, errors in policy. But the same may be said of people on this side of the Atlantic. I am as outraged as any man here at the blood that was shed in Massachusetts. But it is not too late to resolve this matter with one simple plea. No matter your loyalties, no matter the depths of your anger toward the foolish policies of Parliament or the injustices that have been inflicted on all of us by the Ministry, our allegiance is not to those foolish puppets of wrong-headed policy. Our allegiance is to His Majesty the King. We must trust in the King's wisdom, in His Majesty's understanding that it is not the colonies who betray him, but the self-serving, power-hungry minions in his own ministry. I have no doubt that there are those in the King's own government who betray him with silence, who go to extraordinary measures to keep His Majesty in the darkness, unable to hear the cries of his own people. If we apply the energy of this body to one cause, to address the King without the censoring hand of Parliament, reach out directly to King George with the olive branch and allow the sword to fall from our hands, we will be welcomed once more into the loving family from which we have strayed. Dickinson sat down, still staring at Adams. Others began to look toward him as well, expecting a response. He sat in a hot fog, words swirling through him. Hancock motioned toward him, and he wanted to stand to confront Dickinson's astounding optimism when a voice behind him suddenly broke the silence. "Thank you, Mr. President." He realized now that Hancock was pointing past him, and he turned his head, saw Franklin slowly rising. He spun now in his chair, had not heard Franklin say anything thus far, had begun to wonder if the old man spent much of these sessions asleep in his chair. Franklin wiped his eyes now, took a long breath, glanced at him, and Adams could see the old man's energy slowly lifting him, the face now full of light as he began to speak. "I know Mr. Dickinson quite well. I know that he is a man of principle, a man who speaks his mind with a passion and an eloquence to be admired. I recall his opposition to the Stamp Act at a time when I myself did not truly understand what the Parliament was attempting to force upon us. With all respect to Mr. Dickinson, I submit to this Congress my own experience. I have just recently returned from England after a stay of nearly 10 years. In my capacity there as agent for the affairs of 4 colonies, it was my responsibility to deal directly with those very puppets to which Mr. Dickinson refers. I do not dispute his description, and could add a few more epithets of my own." He paused at the scattering of laughter. Franklin adjusted his glasses, looked now at Dickinson. "I do wish to dispute, however, Mr. Dickinson's portrayal of King George as merely a helpless bystander, a man who has been ingloriously shoved aside while his ministers conduct their dastardly business. Perhaps it is the great disadvantage of distance that clouds your eyes, sir. I, too, shared your hope that all could be repaired, that surely His Majesty would not allow his very kingdom to slip away into a morass of chaos and anarchy. You propose yet another petition, I suppose, another address explaining our position, seeking to enlighten His Majesty's understanding of just what is happening to his colonies. May I remind you, sir, that 30 years ago such a petition from this very body was received in London. If the King had any interest in receiving it at all, I assure you, sir, he would have. In fact, the opposite occurred. In my dealings with every part of the government in London, I came to realize, sir, that despite all of your best wishes, and despite all of mine, no decision that floats across that ocean, no order to General Gage, no decree of policy to our governors, no scrap of paper whose design is to assault our very freedom, nothing springs forth from that place without the King's knowledge. And you may be sure, sir, nothing that has so assaulted us does not come here without His Majesty's very blessing. Hold tight to your olive branch if it suits you, sir. I believe it is prudent that we hold a bit more tightly to the sword." Franklin seated himself, and Adams felt the weight of his words, could feel the powerful silence engulf the entire room. It was the first open comment Franklin had made. And Adams looked around now, saw the impact, the others staring at the old man, and slowly they began to stand. The silence broken now by a slow roll of applause, the clapping growing, filling the hall. Adams stood as well, could see that not all of them responded to Franklin's words with enthusiasm, some remaining in their chairs, their hands still, but it was not many. He saw Dickinson sitting as well, the man's thin frailty now magnified by his despair. June 9th, 1775. The word had come several days earlier. More British ships had reached Boston Harbor, a sudden addition to Gage's numbers. No one could be precise, but all the reports suggested that the British now had better than 10,000 soldiers, a force certain to press outward. While no one could be certain what was taking place in Gage's headquarters, it was most definitely a busier place than it had been before. The new arrivals were an unmistakable sign that even before London knew of the disaster on the road to Concord, the ministry had finally acceded to Gage's pleas for reinforcements. Even the most optimistic delegate in Philadelphia understood that a gathering of fresh troops meant something else as well. Gage would have every reason to begin a new round of planning and strategy. There were simply too many soldiers in Boston for even the conservatives to deny that something dangerous was about to happen. As the days passed, the delegates began to respond to their changing situation with more than speeches of rhetoric and philosophy. The reality was heightened by rumor. Troop ships on their way to New York, even Philadelphia, more occupations. As communities from New England to Georgia continued to increase their militia, men continued to gather close to Boston, joining the ragtag mass of colonial troops holding the British in place. Adams had received a letter from Abigail, sat alone in his room, and read it with ice in the pit of his stomach. The British had begun to send raiding parties ashore all around Boston. She had not heard of any bloodshed yet, the raids mainly for forage for horses, but he could imagine the terror of watching red-coated soldiers suddenly appearing on the quiet shoreline, the isolated roads, marching up to his own door, unstoppable, their power absolute, their brutal disregard for protest. He put the letter aside, felt sick, noticed his hands shaking. The ice rose to his chest, and he stood up, paced the small room, felt anger, more, a raw black fury. He tossed her letter aside, both his fists clenched, could think of nothing but the horror, his mind racing with thoughts of soldiers in his house, the children screaming, John Quincy standing up to them trying to protect his mother. He let out a sound now, a quick shout, no words, utter helplessness, dropped down on the bed, one fist punching the small pillow. The door suddenly opened, and he heard Sam, who said, "What is it? You all right?" Adams lowered his head, his shoulders slumped, the awful vision swept away by helpless defeat. He wanted suddenly to cry, saw her face. "God, I miss you. I miss all of you." "What happened, John?" He fought for control, blinked away tears, wiped his eyes now, looked up at Sam. "I'm sorry. A letter. News from home. Something wrong?" "Oh, yes, Sam, something is quite wrong." Adam slowly stood, said, "I must go outside, get some air." He left the room, Sam close behind him, and they moved out through the rear of the tall house, the early morning still holding a chill. They moved through a garden thick with low green plants, the first signs of flowers. Sam stayed close behind him. "You going to tell me what's wrong?" Adam stopped now, turned, looked at him. "We are all in grave danger, Sam. Our families, our homes, everything we have, everything we hold dear. It can be taken away just so easily. We have known that for a long time, John. But this Congress, they don't seem to know it. We debate endlessly about whether or not we have the courage to break away from our beloved king, and all the while his army grows stronger and bolder and more dangerous. How do we convince them, Sam? What must we do to show this Congress that there is only one stand we can take? What do you want them to do, John? We must declare ourselves to be a free and independent country. We must establish ourselves with a government. We must invite alliances with foreign countries, build our own defensive forces. Sam laughed now. Why, cousin, you sound like some sort of radical. Do you have some plan for enticing this Congress to accept these, proposals? Adams felt his anger slipping away, Sam's good humor disarming him. Well, I had thought of presenting these points. And what do you suppose will happen, John? The same thing that has always happened. The radicals will applaud, the conservatives will quiver in their shoes and blame you for blaspheming against everything sacred, and those in between will find a way to change the subject. I find no humor in that, Sam. Sam was serious now, put his hands on John's shoulders. Neither do I. I have spent a good many days sitting in my room alone in darkness, wondering how, after all we have done and all that has happened, we can fight against timidity and stupidity. How can we make the blind see? How many more times will we give them speeches? He moved beside Adams now, began to walk farther into the garden, Adams moving with him. But this morning something has changed. You are different, Sam went on. What got you so upset? A letter from home. Your family is in danger. That had as much an effect on you as anything I have ever seen. That's the key, John. The same fear will affect everyone in that Congress, but it cannot come from speeches. They cannot simply hear it. They must feel it. Every man must feel what I saw in your face, the impact of Abigail's words. When the fear is made real, they will respond. Adams began to feel the excitement returning, the enthusiasm. Sam stopped walking, put a hand on his shoulder. You have a gift, John, a talent I do not have. You understand details. You would not make the same mistakes I would make. You do not have the impatience to attempt to thrust this Congress into rebellion all at once. You must explain to them, show them wisdom, show them logic, a plan. They are like a team of six, the carriage moving only as quickly as the slowest horse. I am too impatient. It's too easy for me to just whip the team. Sam laughed. It doesn't work with horses. And it won't work here. Adams thought a moment, the names running through his mind. We have support from many. It will only take a few. The slowest horse, John. Speak to them. Gentlemen, a pleasant good morning. Both men turned, saw Hancock emerging from the house. He moved toward them quickly, skillfully balancing a small china cup. Have you sampled this coffee? Truly wonderful. I admit it required some getting used to. Sam glanced at Adams. Yes, had my fill earlier. You off to the hall? Oh, quite so. Work to be done. Well, I don't have to tell either of you. There was a silent moment, and Hancock seemed to sense there was no conversation to be had. Well, then, see you in session. He spun away, the cup still perfectly steady, disappeared into the house. Adams stared at the motion of the door. Nice suit. Don't suppose it's English. Sam laughed. French. Maybe Chinese. He finds a way. Sam pulled out a pocket watch, studied it for a moment. I suppose we should follow his example. They'll be arriving even now. And if I know John Hancock, he'll be cornering every one of them, putting in his plea for some kind of appointment. He wants to be a general, you know. General of what? Whatever he can get. The Roman Empire is out of the question. That leaves Massachusetts. Adams shook his head, a new wave of despair brewing. That's not what we need, Sam. Those men around Boston need leadership. Someone who knows something about fighting. My apologies to Mr. Hancock, Sam, but the ability to accumulate wealth does not automatically ensure ability in everything else. Mr. Hancock has proven he is a capable leader of parades. I shudder to think how much pure glee would erupt from the headquarters of General Gage if someone like John Hancock was given command of an army. No matter, John. That opportunity exists only in Mr. Hancock's imagination. The troops will certainly elect their own commander. Adams stared at him a moment, shook his head slowly. No. That is equally as dangerous. Sam, an army is not a democracy. No one miraculously acquires the ability to command because he receives the most votes. There must be other considerations, experience for one. I don't know about that, John. If the troops don't approve the commander, they will simply go home. Sam, you're talking about a mob, not an army. If we are to defend ourselves against the British, we need more than a gathering of angry farmers. We need discipline and drill and regulations. We need regular channels of supply, food and powder, recruitment, organization. A commander must understand all of those things. Sounds like you may be the man for the job. Adams shook his head. No. Oh, no, I could never. I don't have the first element. Experience. All right, then, since you've clearly given this a great deal of thought, do you have someone in mind? Artemis Ward is up there right now, seems to be doing an adequate job. There's Parker, Barrett. Adams stared down, frowning, and Sam said, What's wrong with them? They're all from Massachusetts, Sam. But that's where the army is, John. It has to be an army of all the colonies. We need New Jersey and Delaware to send their own men to Massachusetts. We need whole companies marching up from right here. There will be great reluctance to making this fight, this army, a Massachusetts affair. Sam thought a minute. This could mean professional soldiers. There is great danger in that. A standing army is a threat to liberty, John. We don't need to look at history to see that. We are experiencing it right now. There have to be concessions, Sam. One concession is that we are facing a professional army, possibly the finest army in the world. We cannot fight them with lofty principles. I never thought I would concede an argument to my younger cousin. So, you have someone in mind to command this army? June 15th, 1775. He had entered the hall with the fresh confidence of a lawyer trying the case he already knows he has won. There would be no surprises today, and he took his seat knowing the men around him were watching him, many already aware that much of his work was done, committees already at work on the supply lines, word already going back to each colony to lend support to the military needs of the men in Massachusetts. The debates and grand speeches had grown quiet in recent days, with more smaller meetings, the delegates dividing into specific committees. The larger presentations had become more practical, a growing clarity throughout the entire Congress that such basic problems as communication should be addressed. Ben Franklin was appointed Postmaster General, the same post he had held for many years under a different authority. One committee proposed a call for the colonies to adopt a state of military readiness, which was approved by the vast majority of the delegates, an extraordinary step considering the blunt language and the acknowledgement that war might not be avoidable no matter what resolutions Dickinson's friends might offer the king. Another committee began work on drafting the actual regulations for the operation and management of an army. This morning the tone of the entire assembly was unusually businesslike, small conversations scattered throughout the room. He felt strangely nervous. Had prepared himself to speak, rehearsing his key points in front of Sam early that morning. He knew Sam was still uncomfortable with the notion of a professional military, had tried again to convince him that the necessity outweighed the risk. Sam had listened to his points, had been stoic, only mild approval. He glanced over at Sam, saw him speaking to Patrick Henry, the two men often together, sharing the same hot spirit. Well, Sam, I suppose I can seek little comfort from anyone else now. Either they will approve or they will not. He watched Hancock raise his hands, calling them to order, and Adams sat quietly through the brief convocation, did not even hear the prayer, his mind racing with the anticipation of his speech. He had already told Hancock of the importance of his remarks, had left the chairman enthusiastic with curiosity, and Hancock had assured him there would be no delay, that no one else had requested the floor. The room grew quiet now, as Hancock spoke. "I open the floor this morning to the distinguished gentleman from Massachusetts, Mr. John Adams." Adams stood, felt the eyes on him, took a long breath, tried to grapple with the swarm of butterflies in his stomach. "I would like to say, first, that those of us who come to this Congress from the colony of Massachusetts are as grateful as any man can be for the support you have demonstrated for our plight. I believe that your support has arisen from your understanding that it is not, after all, our plight. What has already occurred there is tragic. What might yet occur could be catastrophic. I am certain that some of you believe that an army of thousands, coiled in waiting like some deadly snake, is a threat only to those who may tread upon it. I would suggest to you that we have been fortunate, all of us, that the snake has stayed within its own boundaries. That boundary thus far is the town of Boston. We already know that the innocent in Boston have seen suffering and deprivations worse than any of us hope to know. I need not detail that yet again. He paused, felt the nervousness lessening, glanced over at Sam, saw a quick nod, a small sign of impatience, the message, "Get to it." By your actions here, you have demonstrated not only to Massachusetts, but to England, that Boston is not alone. A valiant army has arisen, has gathered around Boston to contain the growing threat from the British soldiers there, but, in fact, it is not an army at all. It is simply us. It is private citizens who recognize that no man in this continent has the luxury of sitting home, surrounded by the comforts of family, while close by his own countrymen are denied that very comfort. And so some of you have offered your own, men from great distances shouldering muskets, volunteering to fight if necessary, to fight because they know that if Boston submits to the outrages, is conquered by the enemies of our liberty, then nothing, nothing will discourage the snake from uncoiling, from winding its way into the heart of every city, every farm, every village, every home. He paused again, felt the rising heat in his chest, saw them all watching him, the words pulling them toward him. I am concerned that the extraordinary gathering of what we must now call our own army is, by its very nature, destined to suffer. While we have men in Massachusetts who are rightfully appointed as authority over this army, their skills are not sufficient. It has already been suggested that this Congress consider the adoption of the troops around Boston as an army of all the colonies. It is not reasonable to expect such an army, if it is to be made up of soldiers from the entire continent, to willingly submit to command only by those men appointed by one colony. If no army can exist without the approval of the men who must ultimately follow the orders, it is also true that no army can exist without organization, without equipment, without a means of subsistence. The more time we take to debate proper policy and procedure without implementing them, the more committees we have who deliberate details without fulfilling them, the greater the opportunity for the British to strike out of Boston. I therefore propose that this Congress adopt as a genesis of a continental army those troops and commands now gathered around Boston. I further propose that this Congress nominate a general to exercise absolute command over that army. I understand that there can be great concern on this point. It is a difficult decision. I have in my mind one gentleman for that important command. He is very well known among us as a man whose skill and experience as an officer, whose independent fortune, great talents, and excellent universal character would command the approbation of all America. I believe he would unite the cordial exertions of all the colonies better than any person in the Union. He paused again, scanned the room, saw the men looking around now, saw Hancock staring at him with a broad smile, leaning forward in his chair, preparing to rise. Adams felt a tight knot in his throat. My God, he thinks I'm talking about him. He saw the uniform now. Colonel Washington suddenly rising from his seat near the main entranceway, and Washington quickly and quietly slipped away, out through the door. Adams suppressed a small laugh. Of course he knows who I'm talking about. And he's too embarrassed to hear me say it. Well, all right then. Fair enough, sir. I propose a motion to nominate before this Congress a man from Virginia for whom we all hold the highest respect. I propose to nominate as commander of the Continental Army, Colonel George Washington. He could not help looking at Hancock, the man suddenly deflating, sinking down in the chair. There was a hum through the crowd, no one but Hancock showing any surprise, And now, beside him, a voice rose. It was Sam.
I would second the motion.
Even the most conservative in the Congress could find no reason to object to the appointment of a large, quiet man from Virginia to assume command of the army in its infancy. There could be no disputing that the army did in fact already exist and might be suddenly engulfed in combat the moment the British chose to burst out of Boston. Before there could be discussion over the selection of subordinate generals, proposals for the equipping and financing of the Continental Army, Washington himself had to be persuaded to accept the role, something no one had thought to question. He had stayed for a long time in his room, and Adams had been only one of those who had sought quiet conversation with him, surprised to discover that the man who so willingly wore his uniform might be so overwhelmed with the offer to command an army. June 16, 1775. The chamber was quiet, and Washington rose, pulled a piece of paper from his pocket. Adams could not help a smile. So he does not believe himself to be an orator. I am not aware that should be a requirement for leadership. Washington looked out over the room now, the silence complete. He looked at the paper, slowly read from it. Mr. President, though I am truly sensible of the high honor done me in this appointment, yet I feel great distress from a consciousness that my abilities and military experience may not be equal to the extensive and important trust. However, as the Congress desire it, I will enter upon the momentous duty and exert every power I possess in their service and for support of the glorious cause. I beg they will accept my most cordial thanks for this distinguished testimony of their approbation. But lest some unlucky event should happen, unfavorable to my reputation, I beg it may be remembered by every gentleman in this room that I this day declare with the utmost sincerity, I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with. He stopped, glanced up at the faces watching him, studied the paper again, seemed to search for his place. As to pay, sir, I beg leave to assure the Congress that, as no pecuniary consideration could have tempted me to accept this arduous employment at the expense of my domestic ease and happiness, I do not wish to make any profit from it. I will keep an exact account of my expenses. Those, I doubt not, they will discharge, and that is all I desire. He sat down, the room still in silence. After a moment, men began to rise, gathering around the man in the uniform, who found his hand gripped and shaken, others touching his shoulder, the congratulations and well-wishing now infecting them all. Adams stood as well, saw Franklin close by, made way as the older man moved forward. The crowd thinned a bit, and Adams stood close behind Franklin, saw a scattering of smiles, a show of unbridled enthusiasm that had never before filled the hall. Washington was still shaking hands, wearing an embarrassed smile. Franklin reached out to him, and Washington sketched a bow. "Doctor, I am not so sure about this. I am afraid that I am but an amateur in these affairs." Franklin put a hand on his shoulder, and Adams heard the old man say with a laugh, "So are we all, Colonel. So are we all." Chapter 32 Gage. Boston, May 25th, 1775. He had watched as the frigate sailed in past Castle William. He had known immediately it was not like the others. The larger ships of the line which carried the new regiments to reinforce his troops. He had not bothered to scan the ship with his spyglass, was not curious about her identity, had waited until it was brought close to the wharf, only then had seen the name Cerberus. She was vaguely familiar, a vessel that had done some brief work in and out of New York. He watched as she was pulled tight to the wharf, expected to see a mass of troops lining the rails, swarming in one great column down the plank, soldiers joyous over leaving the bowels of the cramped ship. But there had been no great flow of men. And he understood now it was not a troop ship after all. But there had been soldiers, a few officers. And when he saw the first of the men in the familiar uniform, his eyes had closed for a brief moment, his head down. He had become numb to the anger, could feel only a faint sadness, had expected it for so long now, the ship that brought the man who had come to take his job. He stayed close to the window, made himself watch again, saw a crowd of fresh uniforms emerging from the ship, more than he had expected. A flock of officers, a casual stroll down to the wharf, men gathering on solid ground again, grateful after the long voyage. But the scene was too different from what he had imagined, and he suddenly wanted the long spyglass. What was happening? The office was empty, and he couldn't find the spyglass. It was put away somewhere, the tedious efficiency of Major Kimball. He turned to the window again, saw a carriage suddenly appear on the wharf. Of course, my brother-in-law doing his job. He watched them board, but only a few, the rest waiting for more transportation. The carriage disappeared, and he backed away from the window, felt the sadness deepen, moved slowly to the chair, sat. All right, come on. I'll just wait. He had not been replaced. Instead, the ministry had sent three major generals. By rank, they were his subordinates, and even the quantity did not change the fact that Gage was still in command. But even if there was to be no direct change, the message to Gage was clear. The command might be his, but London was counting much more on these three men to actually do the job. He knew them all. Met them as they entered the office together, a great cluster of power descending on him with the weight of all England. William Howe was the most senior of their rank, his family one of England's most famous, the brother of the admiral who had tried to befriend Ben Franklin. Henry Clinton was likely the most able commander, building a career through service in both the Coldstream Guards and the Grenadier Guards, and hard-charging service against France in the Seven Years' War. John Burgoyne was the oldest of the three, nearly as old as Gage, but by the date of his commission he had the least seniority. All three men were products of the aristocracy. All had been members of Parliament, all had risen to early prominence, largely on the power of their family connections. Now all three had come to Boston, charged by the King and Lord Dartmouth to rescue Gage from what official London saw as an embarrassing predicament. June 16th, 1775. There had been another council that afternoon to finalize preparations for the first grand foray to break the siege holding the army within Boston. The meeting had been no different from the ones before, Gage deferring to the fresh strategy, sitting patiently, enduring the monologues, each man laying out his perfectly conceived strategy, the result of weeks of board confinement on the Cerberus. Gage himself had proposed the overall plan. It made the most military sense to march out of Boston Neck to the southwest, occupying the hills at Dorchester Heights. From there, the British artillery might gain control of much of the rebel position, putting the heavier cannon to good use in breaking a wide hole in the siege. Gage had allowed the men to state their cases again, knew that after all it was the reason they had been sent here. He knew enough of ambition, was aware that each of these men had probably been disappointed to be only one of three and not the one and only to rescue Gage's disaster. Howe had made a good show of discretion, his genteel way of sparing Gage's pride, but he couldn't hide his disdain for Gage's apparent mismanagement of the entire situation. In nearly every conversation, Howe referred to the embarrassment of it all, as though to London and to Howe himself that was the most important consideration to be dealt with. Clinton was a short, stout man who had stayed mostly quiet. It was obvious to Gage that Clinton had difficulty hiding his dislike for the other two men, and the more he spoke, the more obvious it became. Clinton had his own plan, of course, but would not fully discuss it, not yet. Had grave concerns about the ability of Gage's headquarters to hold military secrets. He had no doubt that he had been sent across the Atlantic to be the one who ultimately replaced Gage. Gage ignored the drama and intrigue, had respect for Clinton as a strategist, but suspected that no matter how reasonable Clinton's strategy might be, the others would oppose it anyway. Burgoyne was another matter altogether. Gage sensed that he didn't have any strategy at all, had spent the weeks on shipboard composing a play. Burgoyne had a reputation for a certain theatrical flair. Gage had seen from the first day of his arrival that Burgoyne was much about show, a man who placed great value in the parade. Oddly enough, his men had given him the nickname Gentleman Johnny because he chose to drill and discipline his soldiers with a gentle hand, unusual in the army. But if it made him popular with the foot soldiers, it caused serious doubts among his superiors whether he could ever be relied upon to put his men through a difficult fight. And if there was indeed a problem holding the details and strategy confined within the walls of Gage's office, it was the barkeeps and tavern owners who had learned that John Burgoyne loved to impress an audience with his knowledge of all that would soon happen. Gage had spent much of the evening in the quiet of his den. But he had rarely been alone. He was surprised that Margaret had stayed so close, fixing him tea, fluttering about him like some devoted butterfly. It had been quiet for a few minutes now, Margaret busy with some detail of motherhood, the harsh crying emerging from the baby's room, some difficulty from which he stayed far removed. He sipped the tea, ran his finger along the page of an open book, a half-hearted attempt at reading. But the words were a blur, his mind wandering, and he put the book aside. Too much to expect. She was suddenly at the doorway. "What? Did you call me?" He smiled, waved her into the small room. "I was just grousing. I had thought a nice quiet evening, one long night away from the office, just some time alone, might clear my head a bit. Hasn't worked." She sat in the small chair, put her hands on both knees. "And why does your handsome head need clearing?" He could see playfulness in her, a rarity now. "You are in a strange mood. Perhaps I should plan these evenings more often."
"Perhaps you should. Is that not what this time is for? To escape from all of that duty?"
His lightheartedness dissolved. "Must it give you such joy? Do you take pleasure in seeing my career disappear before your eyes?" He turned away from her, reached for the book again, and she slid the chair closer.
"My husband, what gives me pleasure is to have you home. What would give me greater pleasure is to have all of us together. There is nothing I want more than for you to be my husband and the father of our children."
He had heard it before, stared at the closed book. "You will no doubt get your wish. I am engaged in little more than a performance, playing out the final scene, which I did not write. I am supposed to be elated that I am receiving so much help. Lord Dartmouth expects that now nothing but good news will flow out of here. We have the reinforcements I asked for. We have all of these outstanding generals at my disposal. And of course I have Lord Dartmouth's latest orders. Go to it. Make good use of all this talent and resource. Drive the rebels into the hills. Bring peace and prosperity to our land." She put a hand on his.
"You have always known that they do not understand what is happening here. Now they will hear it from the other generals as well. Surely little will change. Then Lord Dartmouth will hear four voices, not just one. You will be vindicated. Even if they decide to replace you, you can retire with dignity."
He was surprised, stared at her now for a long moment, saw a soft smile. "I have never known you to be so concerned with such official matters. But, my dear, I'm afraid you are wrong. Something will definitely change.
They did not come over here just to observe, nor to repeat my failings, nor to write schoolboy notes to Lord Dartmouth. My orders from the Ministry are more emphatic than ever. Do something. I have been given twice as many soldiers and 3 major generals. Today we put our plan closer to reality, mapped out our strategy for breaking the constrictions around Boston. I regret to tell you, we are in some trouble here. If the rebels put cannon on any of the heights, even 1 gun up there above Charleston would cause havoc here. When the rebels raided Ticonderoga, it changed the equation. We don't yet know what they have done with the cannon, where they might have taken them, but they'll not sit quietly. We must act to stop them from making our life here. Well, suffice to say, if the rebels decide to fire their newfound artillery into Boston, it is unlikely we can stay. In fact, he paused, leaned forward, his hands covering hers. I want you to leave here. I have said this before. It is not safe. It never has been. Now it could become more dangerous. Is New Jersey any safer, Thomas? I have heard the rebels are forming their army in every colony. I was not suggesting New Jersey. I would like you to return to England. If we succeed here and crush this rebellion, you may return. If we do not, then I will certainly be joining you there in short order. She sat back now, and he knew the look, the familiar argument. I will not discuss this with you, Thomas. I will not sail to England, certainly not without you. He knew her resolve, a battle he could not win. He nodded slowly, put his hand on the book again. Perhaps you should go on to bed. I would like to do some reading. She stood, but did not leave, stared down at him for a long moment. He opened the book, made a show of finding his place. Slowly she moved to the door, then stopped. Why must you insist we are better off apart? Can you not just retire? Accept all of that glory you always talk about? Your frustration is so apparent. You have said yourself that there is no satisfaction to be had here. Let us unite the family and enjoy what years we can. Can you not just give the colonists their wretched town? Must anyone else die for your precious king? Her words struck him hard, and he tried to hold his calm, rubbed his fingers along the spine of the book, pushed the anger down hard inside. You are forgiven for your outburst, my dear. He took a deep breath, his words now tightly clipped. You cannot be expected to understand. But you should know your observations are not accurate. If the army withdraws from here, there will be no glorious voyage home. No lofty rewards for your husband's service to the king, no grand retirement. No matter what may come, my fight is already lost. If the rebellion is crushed, those 3 generals will gain all the credit. If we lose, it is because of what I have already done, the mistakes the ministry believes I have already made. She said nothing, still looked away, and he sagged in the chair. I am sorry. It is not appropriate for me to involve you in this. I should leave these matters in my office. I just wish you would consider your own safety, the safety of the baby. She moved quietly away, and he looked up at the open doorway, thought of her anger. I should have reminded her. His Majesty is her king as well. She knows that, of course. It was an angry slip of the tongue, but it was unwise. I should caution her to be careful in what she says. She has too many American friends. It might reflect poorly. She must show respect, even if she does not believe we are doing right here. He felt his frustration rising, could suddenly picture Sam Adams in his mind. Is it not enough that he shames himself before the king? Must his blasted rebellion infest my very home? He still had the book in his hand. Tossed it aside now. Pounded 1 fist hard on his desk. Damn them all. Lord Dartmouth has given me a chance, a final opportunity. There is honor to be had here, and yes, my naive wife. More men
will die. June 17th, 1775. He had barely slept. Avoided his bedroom by staying in his study all night, small naps breaking into his work. He had studied the troop alignments, the positioning of the regiments, which men would be best for the great push out of the city, even though it had already been discussed many times during the councils with the three generals. Even now he could not shake his anger that his own wife seemed not to care about his work, about why he must crush this rebellion. It was nearly dawn, and he moved quickly, felt the need to be out of the house, back to his office. He pulled his hat from a hook by the front doorway, moved outside, the earliest light just finding the wider streets. He had neglected his coat, felt a chill, the cool breeze misting in from the harbor. The walk to his office was not long, and he drew in a deep breath, the salt air filling him. He saw troops, the night guard, still patrolling the street. He moved close to them, and they stiffened, saluted him, and one man said, "Sir, have you seen it?" He was not in the mood for conversation. "Seen what, soldier?" The man pointed out past the houses behind him, said, "Up there, sir, across the bay. We heard it all bloody night. Figured it was some crazy farmer. Excuse me, sir." Gage was beginning to lose patience. "What are you talking about, soldier? I don't have time." They all were staring out now, and he turned, could hear a strange noise, the dull ringing of metal. Voices, drifting across the water, carried on a low breeze. He could see, out to the east of Charlestown, the grey light bringing the hills to life. He could make out motion, men going to and fro, the sounds still coming. "What is it? Who?" He felt a rising knot in his chest. Suddenly realized the odd noise was the sound of shovels, of men moving dirt and rock. One of the soldiers said, "Appears to be rebels, sir." He could see more men now, a column appearing over a crest farther back, above Charlestown, the line spreading out across the hills, then closer, more men moving in line around the fresh earth, the crest of the closest high ground, Breed's Hill, the place he had feared. The vantage from which the cannon of the rebels could destroy his army. No one was waiting for him in his office, and he was surprised that all was quiet, not even Kimball had risen yet. He moved through the outer office with mild disgust. Everyone will sleep late. They were, after all, so very busy last night on a much more important mission. He moved into his own office, closed the door sharply behind him, had never been able to shake the anger over one of the key priorities of the three senior commanders. Gage had been astounded that one notation in Lord Dartmouth's official documents provided that each of the three new arrivees be allotted the sum of £500 from the army's accounts to provide each man with a new carriage. It was an extraordinary bit of luxury in a town where fineries had become non-existent. Gage had been amazed further that each of the men had actually accepted this as perfectly routine, as though, of course, a general should ride in splendor, no matter what circumstance may face his army. He sat at his desk in the silence of the office, his mind racing with details, alternating between impatience and the excitement that this day might finally bring some serious confrontation with the rebels. He had waited for over an hour, spread out a map on the desk, marked with the supposed positions of the rebels' strength. He scanned the map yet again, knew every detail by heart, narrowed his focus to the Charlestown Peninsula, where he had seen the rebels at work. The door suddenly opened, and Howe burst into the room, seemed surprised to see Gage there. "Oh, forgive me, sir, I should have knocked." Gage said nothing, made room for Howe at the map, and soon Clinton and Burgoyne came in as well, scurrying close as though they might miss some vital piece of information. Gage leaned back in his chair. "The shopping go well last night?" Burgoyne jumped at the bait. "Oh, quite, sir. There's a broker here who represents the most prestigious carriage maker in London. He claims they use only the finest inlaid ivory." Burgoyne stopped, and Gage saw Howe's hand on his arm as Howe said, "Perhaps we should focus on the purpose of this meeting. Excuse me, sir, but are you aware what is happening on the Charlestown Peninsula?"
Gage acknowledged Howe's show of proper protocol with a short nod. I saw it myself. Seems the rebels intend to open up a new front. Clinton leaned close.
Forgive me, sir, but I have done a bit of observing on my own. The rebels have gone beyond intention. They have completed construction of a redoubt and a series of earthworks on the crest of Breeze Hill. There are fence lines extending away from the crest of the hill in such a way as to give cover to troops. I have observed a considerable number of muskets moving into position. I can only assume that their artillery is not far behind.
He paused, then looked at Gage.
Excuse me, sir. I have avoided asking this question, but now seems an appropriate time. May I inquire as to why we do not have troops already occupying those hills? It seems a logical position, if not essential, for the defense of Boston.
Gage pointed to the map, the mainland southeast of the town. Look at the map, General. Dorchester Heights, another logical position, and of course there's Cambridge, Roxbury, Salem, too. The fact is, gentlemen, prior to your timely arrival, we barely had enough troops in this command to keep the rebels from marching across Boston Neck itself, not to mention keeping them out of Castle William. I had to make a choice, spread out in an ineffective front, or bring our forces in tight to Boston. The logic of that decision was pretty clear. General Clinton, how many muskets did you observe?
Several hundred, perhaps more.
Howe went on. No criticism intended, sir. If the rebels are marching out onto the hills on the Charlestown Peninsula, it is obvious that our attention should be there as well. We all understand the value of those hills for artillery. While I'm sure we all commend General Clinton for his astute observations, no force of peasant militia is a threat, no matter how many their number. I have given this considerable thought, sir. Simply put, we must clear Charlestown Peninsula of enemy forces completely. With the troop strength now in Boston, we can safely establish a formidable position there to prevent any further incursions. It can also be useful as a staging area for the final push inland against the main rebel positions. Gage sat back in the chair. He's right, of course. If I had the troops, I would have done the same thing months ago. What do you propose, General Howe? Howe pointed to the map. Land two main bodies of troops here and here. If we move in tandem, it does not matter how the rebels may line up. We can assault them in two waves and easily drive them off their hills. Once the ground is clear, we should place field pieces in a pattern suitable to... Clinton interrupted.
A frontal assault? For what purpose? The neck of the peninsula in the rebel rear is quite narrow. With the guns from one frigate close by, we can cover the landing of at least two regiments, who can sweep in behind the rebel position. The rebels would have nowhere to go and would probably surrender en masse. We might not have to fire a single shot.
Howe stepped slightly back from Clinton, looked at him with an air of disbelief. General Clinton, you propose to assault the rebels from behind? The word was expelled from Howe's mouth like a spoiled oyster. He looked at Gage.
Sir, I will not debate General Clinton on the proper etiquette of war, but I assure you, if we form into the position I have suggested, the King's soldiers will present a demonstration like none seen on this continent. I am not concerned with how many rebels are in whatever ridiculous earthwork. Their rout will be complete. I do, however, agree with General Clinton on one point. It is entirely possible we may not have to fire one shot.
Gage looked up at both men, then at Burgoyne.
Your thoughts, General? Do you favor General Howe's plan, or are you more inclined to favor General Clinton's?
Burgoyne swaggered close to the desk, peered at the map, then straightened, seemed deep in thought.
Well, sir, if I may, if the rebels choose to face us, then it seems entirely proper to oblige them. What a lesson! Rebels! We dare you to come out and oppose His Majesty's finest. I believe, sir, it might send a lot of them in a mad scramble to the safety of their wives' skirts.
Clinton seemed resigned to the inevitable.
Sir, at least consent to land a force of men, even one regiment, to block the rebel retreat. If they suddenly confront a solid line of soldiers damming up their one route of escape, we can capture the entire force.
Howe held up his hand. General Gage, if you will allow me, it is best in this situation not to capture anyone.
Would we not better be served by allowing them to flood back into their own headquarters, regaling their leaders with all the luscious tales of terror? Surely that will be a most advantageous weapon. Burgoyne seemed to inflate.
Oh, quite, sir. The sight of so much rabble fleeing for their lives, it could give the men quite a boost, sir, something to remember to their grandchildren the day the rebellion ceased to be.
Clinton gave a slight shrug, looked at Gage.
The decision is yours, of course, sir. You may place me at your service where you see fit. Despite the disregard for my proposals, might I offer one more? Speed, sir. The longer we allow the rebels to fortify themselves, the greater chance their strength might present a challenge.
Gage glanced at Howe, saying, I agree. We will put this into motion immediately. Delay could prove costly. Howe was still looking at the map, confident of his plan, and Gage thought, it should work after all. And we need this, we need the land, we need the victory. Howe continued, The senior officers are already on alert. It will be no inconvenience to have their men moved to the boats and barges. They will be ready at your command, sir. Gage was beginning to feel the excitement again. Yes, very well, General. They should be well rested and well prepared. They have had very little else to do. He reached into a drawer now, brought out a piece of paper. Here's the tidal chart. The land along the peninsula is mostly shallow draft. The high tide will be at about 2 o'clock. The boats can be loaded by noon, Howe replied. The daylight hours will eliminate confusion. Gage nodded in silence. Could not help but think of the embarkation for Lexington, the delays, the supposed advantage of the night time, an absurd joke. He looked toward the window, the dawn now full across the harbor. We have a great deal of work to do, gentlemen. Let us now consider the specific deployment of the troops. I want the initial wave to be the finest men we have. The Grenadiers, the Royal Marines. If this is to be a show, then let it be a glorious show. Now Clinton interjected, Sir, I am concerned about Charlestown. We do not know what may await us there if the rebels have located any sizable force. It could be a tedious mission removing snipers from rooftops. Howe pointed to the map, the waterway beside Charlestown. A simple solution, General. One gunship could provide enough hot shot to eliminate that problem completely. We'll simply burn the town. Call it another good lesson for the rebels. Gage thought of Admiral Graves, the impatience of the old seaman. I agree, General. But the warships can be of more practical use, since we will have the entire morning to observe the enemy positions. With enough cannon fire directed there toward the rebels themselves, we just might expose their greatest weakness. He laughed, caught up in the spirit of the plan, the enthusiasm from the others. Once they have a healthy swallow of what the King's Navy can serve them, they may have no appetite left to face the army. I will order Admiral Graves to move the appropriate vessels into position. He has been rather insistent on my making better use of his ships. This should delight him. The papers began to appear, the lists of units and their commanders, the officers to handle the details. They worked quickly, the efficiency driven by the fresh enthusiasm, drawing up the orders, the timing, coordinating with the Navy. Each of the three moved out with the quick steps of men who know their duty. Gage was pacing the office, looked at the stack of paperwork, the drawings, rough sketches, the plan of attack, the list of companies. He did not try to read any more, the details hard in his mind. He thought suddenly of Pitcairn, remembered the look of utter despair on the Marine's face, the defeat that had so crushed the man's spirit. Well, Major, today you shall have your revenge. Today we shall all have our revenge.
This ends Disc 12.